One in five Australians live with a mental health condition. That's more than 4 million people. But despite it being one of the most common health issues impacting our community, we still find it difficult to talk about. I'm one of those one in five people, and I think it's time we change society's perception of mental illness and how we view those who live with it. Because guess what? We're people like you.
This podcast is brought to you by Sane Stigma Watch in partnership with Mindframe, an Every Mind program. The stories shared on this podcast may be tough to hear. They may hit home a little closely, or you might simply empathise strongly with one of our guests' experiences. Take care when listening, and if you need extra support, visit our website, sane.org.
Hi, I'm Cam Solnadal. I'm a patron with Sane, and I've lived with the diagnosis of schizophrenia for over 20 years. Welcome to episode 1 of We're People Like You. I begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respect to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. We also recognise that lived experience lives here. Sane respects and champions the individual and collective expertise of people with a lived experience of mental health issues and their families and communities, and people impacted by suicide. We recognise their vital contribution at all levels and value the courage of those who share this unique perspective for the purpose of learning and growing together to achieve better outcomes for all. In today's episode, I'm excited to welcome Sam Kisajukian. Sam has been working professionally as a stand-up comedian for 10 years. He's toured globally in the USA, UK, Europe, and all around Australia. He was diagnosed with bipolar in 2022 at the age of 36. He lives in Sydney and has begun touring again after a two-year hiatus. His main focus now is on a multi-arts project titled 300 Paintings that combines comedy and visual art to explore the bipolar mind. And Sam's a Sane Peer Ambassador. Hi, Sam. Welcome. How's your week been?
Good, actually. I was at my parents acquired a farm in near the Hunter Valley, which is about 2.5 hours drive. And so I just spent the week there painting. So there's like an abandoned house on the property that's falling down, and it's like five rooms, and I can damage the walls. So I've just been taping up big canvases all around there and turned it into kind of my head.
So is the abandoned house turning into sort of some sort of performance art? So you've got it like crumbling around you while you're painting?
I'm trying to build myself up as this thing's falling down. It's pretty amazing though, because it's about 100 meters away from the main property, and it's up this hill. And I paint in two sessions. So I'll paint from midday till 7 p.m. and then have dinner, and then I'll paint from maybe 9 p.m. till 2 a.m. And when sometimes my parents aren't there, and I have to get a torch, and it's really misty, and I walk up all these kind of like old posts that are falling down up this driveway, and you just look at this house and the veranda's fallen in, like it really looks abandoned. I watched like a scary movie like a few nights before, and I just like felt like, oh no, it's like haunted.
So if this is the time I'm going to have visual hallucinations, you know, it's going to start now.
Yeah, we'll just chalk it up to mental illness, not that ghosts really exist.
So how did you get to a good week? Has it taken some time?
That's a great question. Yes, that's true. I usually go to the farm either when I need to paint or when I feel overwhelmed being in Sydney. I have a strange relationship with Sydney in that I tend to have to be here because of my job as a comedian. It's a high concentration of places to perform. But I do very much like being in nature and being alone. And now it's nice to have a place that I can go to, because my mental health is very good when I'm by myself or with my family and just painting. Like, that just feels very simple. I tend to get overwhelmed by the complexity of my life in Sydney.
Could I take that juxtaposition for a little bit? What we're talking about is a very safe environment and quite a high stress environment. Can I take you back to about age 14? Who was Sam then?
You know, I think about this from time to time. And I hate to say I have bad poor memory of my childhood. I've just never been someone that has good memory. And I think it's because I'm always either trying to be present. I would say it's trying to escape to the present. If I was to think back, I would say from before the age of 10, I was very confident as a child, problematically so. And for example, I used to tell my mum, I used to give her directions when she was driving, but I was like 7, and she would just look at me and she'd listen, and then she'd be like, "What? You're 7 and you've never even been in the suburb." I'd be like, "Yeah, mum, go left here." So my real nerves was about like just getting in trouble. Like if I'd kind of gone too far with something and I was just sure that I was going to get yelled at by adults. And it wasn't like unwarranted. Like I was naughty. But then as I got older, I moved to Sydney and I changed schools twice because I was originally from Adelaide, moved to Sydney at age 10 and then changed schools again. And I think like, you know, just being in new environments with like very different types of kids, the schooling was very different. I went from public to private and this was very new to me. And there was the new dynamics of like social interactions was just, you know, took some time to adjust to. And it's hard. So I apologize. I don't have great memory of what I was nervous about.
It makes me think, and it could be a very sort of simple lead-in, but did that start making you feel more comfortable in a social group to make fun of things, to make stuff funny?
Yeah, I definitely saw the value of humor as a kind of like social currency and also a way to kind of just like escape anything real. I mean, yeah, I was not really aware of like mental illness as something that was in reference to myself or my family at that point. It just wasn't even on the radar.
So no friends and family had a history. There was no diagnosis or anything.
There's no diagnosis. I was told that my grandmother, my nonna, she's Italian, that she had manic depression. That's what they said it was. I never associated that or understood that was bipolar. But my mum's parents passed away when I was very young, and so I didn't really know them. And my core family group was my grandmother and grandmother on my father's side, who are very strong. They immigrated to Australia from Egypt. They're not Egyptian, but they were Italian, Armenian, Lebanese, Italian on my grandmother's and Armenian, Lebanese. And they came over during the war, after the war. And so I think their focus was on kind of making a life in Australia at a difficult time. And there was just this attitude of just like get on with it because there are bigger things to deal with than just they just chalked it up to stress. If you're struggling, just move on. And I think like I grew up in that environment, so it just wasn't. Maybe it was seen as weakness. I don't know. Perhaps.
I mean, there is so much undiagnosed mental illness from people who have emigrated from the war. The get up and get on with it, you know, my grandma was the same.
Yeah, I think, like, there's a lot of, like, probably intergenerational trauma that's happening. And also, you know, I feel very privileged that dealing with a lived experience of mental illness is the forefront and difficult thing in my life. You know, I feel like my grandparents, that was probably 4 tiers down, you know, they just didn't have time or energy, even though it probably would have helped everything else, like immigrating to Australia, learning English, raising children in a new environment, like getting a house, like getting them through schooling. Like I can imagine it's just, I don't have to do that. So I have the luxury of like tackling my condition.
I mean, we've had the luxury to sit back and look at where we've got to as opposed to them just focusing on doing it, literally having to think about survival and just themselves as a family of a family. You're saying that you found out later that your nonna had manic depression. I mean, I find the diagnosis of a complex mental health issue is so different from anything that I had in mind for my life. When you received it, had it ever been a consideration of yours?
No. It's so funny how surprising it was. And then then when I look back, every ex-girlfriend that I had diagnosed, I feel like partners really like to diagnose you. And they'd all said that they think I had something, and a few said bipolar. And then when I got the diagnosis, I remember I told like 10 people. I was so shy about it. You know, I was like, I have bipolar. And everybody was like, yeah, we know. like I was like the last person to find out, but it was almost like they were like, Sam won't listen. Like he needs to kind of get to this on his own. And I think I probably was aware that I had something, but I almost, and this is something in me, if you tell me how to do something and what the solution is, I will go out and do every single other possibility to try and arrive at that destination. And I think like the goal is like self-understanding. Like that's always been a big thing for me, like really trying to understand like existence and, my mind and dreams and human psychology. And just, you know, I did philosophy at university and math. So my brain is just like in this kind of abstract realm. And so I think it was like the easiest solution was like bipolar. And I could never arrive at understanding because I was never accepting or exploring the framework and lens of bipolar. I just thought I was trying to, it was like I was trying to understand and fix myself, but there was a chemical imbalance in my brain that was kind of warping the lens that was allowing me to kind of analyze myself. So yeah, it was good.
A friend of mine, when I was early in my diagnosis and really not accepting of it, he said to me, he goes, mate, the one thing you're trying to do is fix yourself with the very thing that's broken.
Yeah.
And that was a revelationary moment for me. It finally made sense that no matter what I do, I will keep going in circles because I literally chemically can't find the tools to push past it.
Yeah. This idea that I've always had is like just trust my feelings and trust my gut instinct. And I think that was the problem. And this is something that I try and do now is that, and I don't let like the diagnosis define me. I kind of think of it as like a duality. So there's like Sam and as I was, and then there's also a medical diagnosis of bipolar. And I try and look at situations now through the lens of both, you know, so I'll just be in a situation and then I'll have my feeling of what I want my response to be or for my behavior. And then if I'm a little bit uncertain, I'll then like take a sidestep and like look at it through the lens of bipolar. And then I'll say, oh, maybe Sam, you know, don't do 10 more paintings until midday because you want to build a box of paintings that can go around someone's head and then you can spin it. Maybe just like go to sleep and we can look at this in the morning. And I think, oh, yeah, okay, maybe I'll try that. And then I wake up and I'm like, wow, I'm so glad I just went to sleep.
Is sleep a good ingredient to get you back into a flow state?
I think, yeah, it's just like a necessity. Like I just, I think like not so, yeah, I don't know. It's just as a precursor. There's probably like, you know, 10 different things that I could do that start to push me towards like mania. And because I wasn't aware of them, that, you know, lack of sleep would then mean that I would start drinking more coffee and, you know, at that point, like smoking more cigarettes because I was trying to keep my brain active. And then that would cause me not to sleep as much. And then I would eat less. And so then there's all these things that are starting to stack up to slowly push you into like a hypermanic, manic state. And so now I'm just fully aware of them. So like I'm trying to eat really well. I make sure I get 8 hours sleep. If I have less, then I try and catch up on it or have like a nap. And even when I don't want to, like my default, and there's someone called Erica Brennan who works for the Sydney Fringe, gave me the best advice, and I hold on to it. She goes, when in doubt, do less. And that's been a problem for me my whole life because I'm like, when in doubt, and it's like an insecurity thing, I'm like, do more. Like, take on way more than you can handle and then, you know, try and fill that space. It's like I've always done things that are very high stakes and like I rock climb for 20 years overseas, and I used to just live in a tent and then go rock climbing every day. And I think I was attracted to like the danger. And I used to bodyboard in places where the waves were kind of dangerous. And I do stand-up comedy, which is kind of like a fear of public speaking. You can fail and people can really judge you. And it's weird that I just keep doing these things. And I look back and I think like it's I used to be really value being in the present. And I think for so many years, really what I was doing, people say it's good to be present. And I don't agree with that entirely. I think it's like your intention for wanting to be present. And I think like I was trying to escape to the present, because if I was in the present, I wouldn't have to worry about things. Now, the problem is I get bored so easily that if something isn't really high stakes, like I just lose interest in it very quickly. So I just need like, I literally need impossible tasks. And the problem is that I just love the process. And the thing is, when it gets to the goal, I get no value out of it. Like I could succeed with something and I never, like people say, oh, are you happy or proud? I never feel proud. I just want the problem. Like I just want an impossible, unsolvable problem, because that makes me just fully focus on that thing. And I think like that's how I've dealt with my bipolar for so many years, is that a degree of mania is amazing for solving or just tackling impossible problems, because you have no fear, you have no doubt, your mind is so creative, so you can actually think in ways that systematically you wouldn't usually think in. And so I've always leaned into it without realizing. So whenever I get manic, I always try and do impossible things.
You were saying that all of your friends or most of your friends knew before you did. When you finally came back with that and said, yeah, okay, guys, yeah, you're right. What was that like? Was it a safe environment? I mean, how did that go for the first couple of weeks when you have that comfort of your social circle, of your close friends, not sort of the people on tour, but your actual comfort moment where you can, were you able to finally sit down and say, hey, guys, this is what happened? How was that support? What did that look like?
It was amazing. I thought that people would, I had a fear that people would label me as crazy, and I learned very quickly that by saying I have bipolar, people had a lot more understanding. And they would also have, this is a funny thing I've realized, the diagnosis is helpful for me because it gives people that don't understand my mental states a word to then make sense of me. And I don't care if it's not accurate. It's a safe word for them, because they say Sam's behavior can be explained. If I don't understand it, I'm not going to label him crazy or a psycho. He has bipolar. And I've heard that word and I know what it is. And that's something so when in doubt, we give Sam space. And that is the best thing for me, because it allows like a buffer. Because before, people try and interpret my behavior, but now they know, oh, well, we can't understand that. But he knows what this is. And so he can solve it in his own time. And so now it's given me the space. So in a weird way, because I have that space, I'm able to act more to my level of comfort, which then doesn't trigger me so much more into depressive and manic swings. And I realize, like, acting the mania and depressive states of bipolar in social situations without having the understanding and label of bipolar scares people a lot more than just telling them I have bipolar, which then allows people to give you space, which means you don't have those swings as drastic, or I don't have those swings as drastically. So it's kind of helped on two fronts.
For someone who's listening to this now, who's just been diagnosed or has a friend who's just been diagnosed, what is bipolar not?
Great question. That is such a hard question. I think like also it's like very new to me. I haven't been diagnosed for a long time, and I wouldn't want to. It's perhaps it's hard though, because I don't know. I think like a lot of these the diagnosis is I've noticed is both complex and it can happen very quickly, and uh, you potentially could get misdiagnosed. And, you know, you remember you are putting into words something that a psychiatrist might diagnose you either quickly or over a period of time. And I think people's, you know, with bipolar, the thing is it covers so much thing. I'll explain it from my perspective. So I would get frustrated with the world because I didn't feel understood. And then it would push me into a depressive state. Or if I had something that I couldn't handle, a big goal that I was procrastinating on, I would move into avoidance, which then would mean that I'd have no activity and it pushed me into a depressive state. And then I wouldn't be able to do anything for a long period of time. And I'd get so frustrated that the only way I could get out of that was to try and engineer a manic state. And so my depression would push me and motivate me to trigger into mania, which then would escalate. I'd get everything done and then I would crash out again. And so and stand-up comedy, when I toured, I performed, you know, 100 times over a month, would push me into like these states of like high adrenaline anxiety, which would then further. So we got anxiety, depression. I mean, there are a lot of people that, you know, face this. And I feel like in a strange way, it's like, it's hard to know what's masking what, and it's like, how much is lifestyle? So I just think of like bipolar as like a starting point. It's a helpful thing to help me to help me kind of look at my life and start removing these behaviors that cause, you know, states of mind that then kind of trigger me. So I don't know, like, maybe how would you answer that question?
So for me, schizophrenia is not the split mind. That's dissociative identity disorder. If you want an example of that, watch Mr. Robot. You know, that's a masterful series.
Yeah.
What I'm also trying to do, in a sense, is reclaim the difference between an ongoing diagnosis of schizophrenia and a psychosis, a state of psychosis, you know, a first-stage psychosis.
Yes, okay.
There is no getting around the fact that, yes, somebody in a first-stage psychosis can likely be so terrified that they become violent. There is no getting around that. But I also use the analogy that if you were to look at one of those global maps of all the planes that are currently up in the air, we only focus on the one that crashes.
Yeah, that was very good. I appreciate you saying that.
And the thing that I've had to mask over the years is that I feel like I'm not allowed to get angry, because suddenly if I get angry, then yeah, like, oh, he's a psycho, he's schizo, you know? So, you know, you have to try and negotiate that level of stigma.
Yeah, I think that's like a big one, is like I feel like I have to be more restrained now, which has its own host of problems, because I don't, like, I kind of feel like I don't want to be labeled as a psycho or be labeled, because yeah, you're right, people just remember the like the most irrational thing that they've perceived that you've done. And, you know, like the later stage of my mania, like, that's what people remember, you know? So I'm like, I feel so scared to like even let that happen again, you know?
So how did you and COVID lockdown come up with 300 paintings?
The depressive state of being isolated and not being able to do my job, which is live performing. And I perform every night usually. And as I said, I think stand-up comedy was regulating my bipolar in a way, is that I'd be a little bit depressed during the day and then I would kind of build up a bit of anxiety till the performance. The performance would kind of put me into a peak state and then I would taper off afterwards. So it kind of like engineered these kind of mini cycles. And then when I would tour, I'd kind of enter a degree of mania over a 3-month tour and then I would crash out. So it was almost like a forced structure of my bipolar state. And so, but that was a system that I had that was consistent every year. And then to take that away, my mind was still wanting to do these things. And then when I didn't have it, I needed an outlet and I needed something high stakes. And so I started painting and I try to treat it like a performance, where I was like, okay, the painting is the performer and I'm the audience and I'm going to make a mark, first mark, and then I'm going to respond as the audience with yes, no, this is fun, we want you to go this way. And then I would just kind of have this dialogue. And I realized the painting was almost, you know, an internal state of myself. And so I was building this dialogue with myself. So I was talking to myself in the most like intimate way for the first time in my life. And so I was like, well, I got 36 years of conversation that I've missed out on. Like, let's go. And that's what I realized is your body holds, your nervous system holds your history. And in a way that's much more conscious than, you know, people really, you know, my head is very subjective. My body is not subjective. It is processed reality. It's stored it. And so painting is very physical. And I paint quite large. And so in a way, I was kind of transferring. I feel like everything is a self-portrait because the way that I move, the way that I hold my shoulders through, you know, different interactions and trauma, the way that I react to the things I like and don't like has been shaped by this. So I thought, what is the most accurate portrayal of who I am is literally just responding to each mark and allowing my body to kind of make these marks, which then form this image that I can then look at. So it was that plus an impossible goal of like, you know, well, I started with painting and it moved into inventing and a space museum. Anyway,
your family are also very creative. Do you think that in that isolation, there may have been that link that as you were painting and starting to process your thoughts and emotions while you were doing all that, could that have been sort of a way to hearken back to a safe space with you and your family because there was a lot of creativity in your family as well?
Yeah, my mum is an artist and I think it's like maybe I was 36 and still being a kind of teen that was rebelling in the sense that I was like it's in my blood, you know, it would have made more sense to just be an artist. And I dropped out of art at school and I was like, no, I'm going to go in my own direction. And then, you know, it's almost like just arriving at the correct point after 36 years of trying to do things in all these other ways that really didn't suit me in the same sense. But yeah, my mom is the best. I lucked out so hard. She's the best. And she's very calm, very sensitive, and very astutely aware. You know, she meditates. She spends a lot of time growing radishes in her garden. She's got chickens, but she's named all of them, and she talks to them. And like, she's really every single life form has to exist and is of value. And I think like having that as a kind of mentor creatively has been very helpful. And she knows me so well, and also my psychology and I think my paintings are very psychologically rich, is that we're able to have conversations about them. So like a lot of my therapy is literally just talking to my mum via painting, even though that's not the intention. Like, I have a lot of understanding of what I'm being egotistical about, or, you know, a big thing for me is like identifying as an artist is a massive problem. Like, I don't want to do that because I think once you do that, then the rules of what an artist should be start to occupy in your mind, and you make something, you're like, is this art? And I think that's like the worst thing, you know? And so she kind of helps me do that. But I didn't pay attention to it for a long time because I had no interest in art, but now I do.
How has your medication altered your creativity? Has it changed it? Has it balanced it out? Has it helped with that? When you went from non-medicated, unstructured to starting with a medication structure, how has that helped and changed? And just to disclose for listeners, everyone's medication prescription is unique to them.
I mean, I understand. I think this one's very common, and my psychiatrist was slightly apprehensive about it. Because he said that it essentially like lifts the depression, but it can also trigger mania. He said that this was the medication that has a minimum effect on slowing the kind of like synapses firing, which is essential for stand-up comedy. You just gotta have to be quick, and so it has. It's been fine. My memory's not as good, which is a problem because it's never good. But then it's kind of nice because so I have less things to worry about because I don't even think about them. But that's kind of come back. It's kind of just like leveled me out a little bit. Like, my depression doesn't last for as long. And I think my mania is, it doesn't help with mania at all. It only helps with it kind of lifting the depression. But I don't use mania to get out of the depression anymore. And it's not so bad and severe. I think the diagnosis helps me kind of prevent the mania from happening and understanding and structures around that. The medication just stops me being in the depressive cycle for as long.
I'm so glad it's helping, mate.
Thank you.
How have your adventures in the mental health system been?
I think leading up to it, it's the hard thing was like post-COVID. There's a lot of steps to getting a diagnosis, and there's the first like your own understanding, getting to a crisis point where you think like you've run out of options. And you're like, I need to take this next step, and so you have this very vulnerable state of like, I think I have something that I need addressing. And as a guy, it's like very scary to admit. Like for me, I was like, this is a week. I felt like at the time I was something was wrong over the week and I didn't want to admit it. And then I was having to like email like psychiatry clinics. Like, I think that I have, I'm like trying to diagnose myself. I think I have this and I would like to. And then you get these emails back like, sorry, we're booked up for 6 months. And you're like, ah, you get another email back where someone doesn't want to deal with you because they don't focus on that thing. And then, see 7 emails to different people you've researched and they all come back no. And then you get one and they say, okay, we've got an appointment in 3 months. And you think like, it took me the courage to get to this point now, that now I have to wait 3 months. So it's like, it's hard to get in the system. And then, once you're in it, it's like very expensive. And so you're like, is it worth it? Like, could I just not get the diagnosis and save $1,000? Like maybe that would be, I could use, So I think that was the hardest thing for me. I was lucky in that. And I'm sure people are much harder, adventures in the mental health system. Mine was pretty quick. Like mine was like I've got the diagnosis, like I've got the medication, and I like to solve everything myself. So I'm like, even just getting a little bit of help, like medication, diagnosis, so I can put this framework, is like, I'll just go back to doing everything myself again with this new framework. And that's like, I'm lucky in that. That just suits me because I'm not good in being in like social structures on a consistent basis.
I mean, talking about therapy, you're looking at $400 an hour. And in my breakdown, I was able to get around 12 months to 18 months of therapy. And then it was just too expensive. And I just had to bang myself back together.
Yeah.
But, we're definitely still struggling. And the fact that you were told, yeah, we can see you in 6 months, that is something that is still a big issue in the whole country.
That's very true. I think that's the thing that I think is not really addressed by conversations about COVID. People want to forget COVID and move on to life, and I understand that. But I think anyone that had like underlying mental health issues or, could get a diagnosis but were not aware of it, all of this just came to the surface. And then it just flooded psychiatrists. And so not only are people in Australia most in need at the moment, but they also, it's the hardest to get help.
For you, what is not working currently? What is still something that you're struggling with?
Yeah, it's intangible. I think I've kind of built up a life that's pretty bipolar. Like it's like, if I've been bipolar for such a long time, like my life kind of resembles that in a physical, so it echoes back at me. And so I've got, I'm in a big warehouse by myself, surrounded by hundreds of paintings that are all looking back at me and, like sharing all this information. It's like, it's chaotic. I do stand-up comedy that's like splintered all around different things around the world, friends everywhere, that like now I'm like, okay, I see a path to kind of move forward, but my life doesn't reflect that. And so I'm trying to like fix this kind of thing, that this system that I've built that doesn't serve me anymore. And the weight of that system is the norm. And so I'm trying to build space to kind of reassemble everything, but that takes a lot of energy to restructure. And I'm also spending a lot of my energy focusing on my mental health and to like adjust your situation as well as focusing on your mental health. and you know, watch my energy levels between the duality of performing and doing art is just like, I think like anxiety is like probably the biggest thing for me at the moment. I think with the diagnosis and trying to re-enter society and work to the level I was before, yeah, anxiety is like the biggest thing. I get very anxious and stressed.
So you're about a year in now. At what point did you go from managing bipolar to living with bipolar?
I think maybe like September last year. So I got the diagnosis in May 2022, and then I started performing again. And then in September, I won the Sydney Fringe Best Comedy and Director's Choice Award for a show that I wasn't going to do. And then the Sydney Fringe called me up and said, "We really like the idea of the show. Like, we would love you to do it." And then so I did three shows, and I think that was like a big. It was like validation that, you know, it was the first time I'd ever like shared things in a very vulnerable way. I was like, okay, I've tried to entertain people for 10 years and now I'm just going to show them who I am. And like, for me, I was like, how do I literally show them? I was like, well, I'll just get a projector and just show them 300 paintings and talk through what I was thinking at the time, a little bit about each painting, and then how I look back on it now with my diagnosis. I was literally like, visual verbal communication is the clearest way I can show people who I am in and out. And it was a really intense show and I delivered a lot of information. And then after the award, I was like, oh, okay, I found a way to perform in a way that I enjoy it. Cause I quit stand-up because it wasn't serving me. I didn't enjoy it anymore. And so now I was like, okay, I've publicly told a bunch of strangers that I have bipolar. So there's not really any going back from this now. So I'm like, it was almost like a way, like doing a show saying I have bipolar is like almost like, now I can't get out of it. Like, I'm telling everyone I have bipolar. So now I can't get away. Like, if you get a phone call or I've like got an invention, like you can't believe me. Like, you can't buy into my reality because you're like, I know what this is. Like, I've pretty much safeguarded myself by telling everyone so that I'm held accountable, that I can't like convince people of my reality because they'll be like, oh, it's bipolar. So, yeah.
Last question. How's the rest of your week looking?
Look, I'm going to Newcastle to do the show on Friday, and then I'm back in Sydney, and then I'm just getting all the paintings together to install for my show on the Rocks. I'm doing an exhibition with I'm actually going to install about 50 paintings, and then I'm doing a show on weekends for 5 weeks, and then people will see the show, and then I'll take them around the exhibition. And so literally my next week is like finishing off a couple more paintings and then starting to do all the logistics for the install. And yeah, that's it.
Sam, thank you so much. We could talk to you for another hour, mate.
Oh, thanks, Cam.
Thanks so much, mate.
Don't miss new episodes as they drop over the coming weeks. Subscribe to the Where People Like You pod on all the usual channels. Share episodes you find interesting with your family, friends, and colleagues on social media, tagging Sane. Where people like you.